Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Radio Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the October 28, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read a short story by Tessa Hadley and an article on using science to help us change bad habits. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section entitled The Bunty Club by Tessa Hadley. Serena was out in the garden in the early morning before her two sisters got up. It was the best time. Reflected off the estuary water, the light seemed a blonde powder, sifted through the summer air onto grass that grew waist-high, its mauve seed heads heavy with dew that soaked her skirt. She dipped to wash her arms in it, even her face. She was fanciful and ecstatic, and she loved long grass. Earth smells and the pungency of privet and balsam were still acute at this hour, unmingled. The shadows were as bold as in a child's picture book. Swifts and house martins tracked across the pale sky overhead, shrilling in thrilled anticipation. Everything was to come. This unknown day. The garden was so much more lovely now, Serena thought, than in the past, when it was scrupulously cared for. A crimson rambler rose, unmoored from its trellis, had flopped fatally forward into the grass, where it bloomed copiously, but mostly unseen. Flower beds were knotty with convolvulus and bramble. The dense hedge of blackthorn and holly had grown too thick and high for her to see over the top. She was alone, enclosed with everything enchanting, hidden. And yet the house itself was unromantic, a stolid Victorian villa, built of massive blocks of red sandstone on a steep hill overlooking a small seaside town. Beyond the house, the road meandered upward past more villas, and then dustily through a cluster of old cottages to the medieval parish church, which had a distinguished rood screen. It opened up above the town onto headlands, scrubby with gorse and heather, with views of the water all the way across to Wales, before dwindling into a gravel car park where it ended. Here, on the hill's lower reaches, the old-fashioned hotels and detached large houses had been intended to accommodate a certain sort of privileged, discreet, unexceptional, unchanging middle-class existence, which had changed, after all, because it hardly existed any longer. A number of the houses had been turned into nursing homes. The hill looked across, with a distaste that it mostly kept to itself, at the white pavilions of the holiday camp on the other side of the town, which hosted wrestling weekends or heavy metal or evangelical ones. When Pippa, the eldest of the sisters, ventured out from her bedroom with sponge bag and towel to use the bathroom. Jillian, the middle one, was also venturing. "Beat you," Jillian even said, dashing ahead through the door as if they were still 15 and 17. But they were middle-aged now, self-consciously aware, as they performed their jokey girlishness, of the heavy shelves of bosom under their nightdresses. They had outgrown Fern Lodge, the house that had seemed so spacious and gracious when they were children in it. Pippa and Jillian both had adult children of their own, and careers behind them. They lived in two different northern cities, and each owned, jointly with a husband, still more or less on board, a big house with ensuite bathrooms for every bedroom. Jillian, who was the most businesslike and got on with things, had grandchildren, too. Serena, the youngest sister, was different. She lived alone in London. The three of them were assembled in their childhood home because, a week ago, their elderly widowed mother had fallen and was now in the hospital. They were taking it in turns, two at a time, to drive the 45 minutes to the hospital and spend the day with her. although she seemed barely to know that they were present. Waiting in her bedroom for the bathroom to be free, looking out through the gap where the curtains never quite met in the middle, Pippa caught sight of Serena drifting in the garden and was irritated, partly because the neglected garden made her feel guilty. If Serena wanted to commune with nature, she thought, she might as well take the secateurs with her and achieve something. Or the strimmer. Pippa had bought a strimmer at Argos the last time she'd visited, though no one had tried to use it yet. Still, the morning was lovely, and she lifted her face to the yellow light and heat that splashed through the curtain's gap. Hadn't she made these curtains herself more than 40 years ago? Unconsciously, her fingers sought out a place where the thread on the sewing machine had snarled under a seam, and she couldn't be bothered to unpick it. She had been too eager to see the curtain's finished effect. The mustard-yellow Laura Ashley print was peppery with age, faded almost to white. Pippa met her own eyes in the round mirror that hung above the chest of drawers. Those same eyes had once concentrated on themselves in that mirror with keen hope as she painted on her first eyeliner. Now she was in her late 50s, with a craggy, plain face, which was partly a relief. At least I've got that over with, she thought. Her love for certain unattainable, rough-town boys had been an anguish, she remembered them, surprised because she was used to thinking of them, if she ever thought of them, with fond condescension as a bit of a joke. Meanwhile, Jillian shuddered at the bathroom's dubious flecks and stains and gritty surfaces, the yellowed toilet brush clogged with paper, the packets of laxatives and tenna lady pads out of on unapologetic show. Their mother had a cleaner, but she wasn't much good. Julia and Pippa had worked up quite a head of indignant steam, uncovering the signs of her neglect around the house. Jillian had meant, on her days off from hospital visits, to give the whole house a deep clean, and then was taken aback by the depth of her own reluctance to tackle the job. But why should she, after all, if the others didn't care? Instead, she'd trekked sturdily in the sunshine, pleased with herself, 3 miles each way along the coastal path, using the expensive boots and walking poles she'd bought last year for a holiday in the Lake District, taken without her husband and with a woman friend, although nothing sexual. In the bathroom now, she managed fastidiously by standing on one clean towel and drying herself with another. How long, actually, had it been since their mother had had a proper bath? She wouldn't hear of installing a shower, and yet even Jillian didn't find it easy to climb in and out of the deep tub, its enamel dulled to gray by the innumerable baths the family had run in it over the years. Such thunderous floods of hot water, walls and mirror dripping time and again with condensation. Such intimate smells, pleasant and unpleasant. Such fun, the bubble baths and slippery, screaming games. And then later, such secret longings and excitement and dread, solitary behind the locked door. Hair dye and Tampax and vomiting, girl flesh burgeoning out of control. Thank goodness all that was over with. All clear, she hallooed when she had finished, popping her head, dowager-like in its wrapped towel around the door to Pippa's room. Jillian was quicker and lighter on her feet than her older sister, worked harder on her appearance. She had her gray hair chopped stylishly short and favored big dangly earrings. Pippa was bookish where Jillian was capable. She wore her hair pinned up or in a long plait on one shoulder, which someone had once said, long ago, when it was still a rich chestnut brown, made her look like an Augustus John gypsy. Still, you could see the two sisters' close likeness. They were big and broad-shouldered like their father, with forthright, open pink faces, long, flat cheeks, an obstinate, set jaw. Both sisters had recently retired. Jillian had done something high up in management for the National Grid, and her husband had a business making thermostats for heating systems. Pippa's husband worked on the 18th century in the history department at Leeds University. She had been the director of an archive at the City Museum. "Bathroom's empty," Jillian said. "You should get in quickly before Serena embarks on any aromatherapy. I wish she'd wash the bath out when she's finished." "Well, she's up already," Pippa said. "Look, worshiping in the garden." Jillian came to stand beside her, and together they watched Serena dance in the long grass, flitting like a sprite in her tiered black cotton skirt and satiny top, which she had most likely got at a charity shop. She was solemn about waste and recycling. 7 years younger than Jillian, an afterthought in the family, their father's favorite, fey and fine-boned, Serena had had whatever success she wanted with the town boys and disdained it. She exasperated Pippa and Jillian because she was intolerant and touchy, had no sense of humor. Everyone trod carefully around Serena. As a newborn, she'd been very sick with a hole in her heart. Their father, who was the headmaster of the local secondary school and a lay preacher in the C of E, had prayed over her cot in the intensive care ward, begging God to save her. No doubt that had affected her character. Serena lifted her bare feet high and thrust out her arms, and Jillian said that she was doing Tai Chi. Serena must have heard them murmuring because she turned her face up toward the window and smiled at them, without interrupting the stately sequence of her moves. And they could see that she wasn't as pretty as she used to be. In the strong light, she looked drawn and faded, her arms and neck skinny. The two of them meant to say something dry and funny about their sister. But they were ambushed then by a sadness that had mostly evaded them, in spite of the fact that they were here in their old home, waiting most probably for their mother to die, and for the end of their past. Sadness made its claim on them now, winding through the daily clutter like a long, cool note played on a flute. It was Pippa's turn to stay behind, while Jillian and Serena drove off to their vigil at the hospital. She got the strimmer out of its box and read the instructions, but recoiled from actually attempting to use it. All that crude noise and violence erupting into the peace of the empty house and garden. There was no hurry, anyway. The others wouldn't be back till late afternoon. She had all day to cut the grass and make something for supper. Wandering around the downstairs room, stuffy with heat, their light thick with dust motes, the blinds at their windows lowered to half-mast, as they always were in the summer, she pressed down keys, startling herself out of her own reverie, on the out-of-tune piano, which none of them had played with any talent. In the years since their father died, their mother, Evelyn, hadn't changed anything in these rooms, less out of respect than out of indifference. The old-fashioned good taste and extreme orderliness had been their father's idea, it turned out, not hers. Gradually, after he was gone, the place had filled up untidily with her hobbies, oil painting for a while, then weaving, then the University of the Third Age. Photographs of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and the cleaner's great-grandchildren were propped at random behind ornaments on the drawing-room mantelpiece. There were sacks of birdseed on the teak sideboard in the dining room. Also, she'd stopped attending church. She'd surprised Pippa recently by insisting that what she wanted all of her life was to run a farm, though of course there had never been any serious possibility of that. Evelyn's father's farm, adjoining the edge of the moor above the town, had been passed on, without even a discussion, through the male line to her brother first, and then to her brother's son. Anyway, Evelyn had always been vague and shy, thin and awkwardly elegant, with a muffled irony. You couldn't imagine her in caked boots in the muck, or castrating lambs, or perched high in the driver's seat of a tractor. Pippa was embarrassed by these gauche, and faintly theatrical eruptions of veiled feminist protest coming so much too late. Wandering upstairs to her bedroom, Pippa checked the emails on her phone, then succumbed to the desire to lie down on the bed with her George Eliot novel. She couldn't remember the last time she had laid down to read during the day. It was like being a teenager, time stretching out voluptuously in all directions. Dreamily, she even half imagined that she could hear her mother at work downstairs. A consoling clatter of pans and crockery in the kitchen. Water running in the sink. Voices rumbling on the radio. As if some substratum of ordinariness were so fundamental that it must always be carrying steadily on somewhere below all the agitation of change. Though Pippa sometimes asked herself what their mother had actually done all day when she was keeping house, she had seemed so perpetually worn out and preoccupied, yet she'd always had help with the cleaning and ironing, wasn't much of a cook, disliked entertaining, and had never worked outside the home. Pippa and Jillian had managed bigger households more robustly alongside full-time jobs. Then Pippa became absorbed in Maggie Tolliver's forbidden meetings in the Red Deeps with wounded, intelligent Philip Wakeman, her efforts on to love him. Pippa urged her on, love Philip, not handsome, conventional Stephen. Though she'd read the book many times before and knew what must happen. Eventually she fell asleep, Maggie's travails merging with her own. She woke only hours later in the early afternoon when someone rang the doorbell. With a stale mouth and a ghastly fog in her head, she struggled up and hurried downstairs, blinking into the confusing shadows of the hall. Its tiled floor was dazzling, spattered with ruby and emerald and topaz light, beamed through the stained glass picture panels in the porch door, a heron among green reeds, a kingfisher beside a stream, a swan on its nest. When she opened the door, a man in a sleeveless orange vest and shorts and ragged trainers was leaning against a porch post, chewing, one foot on the ground and the other knee jackknifed up in front of him. He spat out his gum apologetically and held out a hand and said that he was Sean, a friend of Evelyn's, and he'd come to ask after her. He was lanky and rangy, good-looking, browned by the sun. Although he arranged his face to be exaggeratedly solicitous, the way he sprawled there and sought out her glance sympathetically with his own seemed at first to Pippa provocative and challenging, insolently flirtatious. He had the local accent slow and suggestive even when there was nothing to suggest. For a moment, she thought he might be one of those town boys she remembered from her past. But he was much too young for that. 20 years younger than she was, probably, or 25. More like the age of her oldest son, although he didn't look after himself the way Toby did. Sean was muscled, not from the gym, and there was a defiant, leering gap in his grin, where one of his front teeth was missing. She repeated to him the familiar litany of their news. That their mother was mostly sleeping, and when she did wake, she seemed very confused. The doctors couldn't predict what kind of recovery she'd make. They thought the fall might have been due to a seizure. Sean asked if there was anything he could do. Pippa said she didn't think so, but it was very kind of him to offer. "I'm used to doing a few odd jobs around the place for Evelyn." "Oh, I see. You mean for money?" He stood up on both feet, away from the porch, frowning as if he were offended, and said that he was happy to work for nothing at a time like this. Pippa was compromised. "Sorry. No, I'm happy to pay, but I don't think there's anything, though I suppose there is the strimmer." So it was that, when Jillian and Serena arrived home a couple of hours later, they found the deep peace of Fern Lodge ravaged by the strimmers snarling and whining as Sean, shirtless, went at the long grass in the garden, filling the air with whirling, glinting dust and shards. It had taken some comradely effort between him and Pippa to assemble the strimmer and go through the instructions. Then, while it was charging, she'd made him coffee. Before he attacked the grass, he'd hacked away with a pruning knife he'd fetched from the shed, as if he knew his way around, at the brambles overgrowing the flower bed. Serena heard the strimmer as soon as she came through the front door and took in its implications like a blow. She walked straight through the house and burst out again at the back through the French windows in the dining room into a scene of devastation. Grass lay in heaps where it had fallen on the ragged, pale stubble. White-faced, her black eye makeup incongruously gothic in the strong light, she turned on Pippa in impotent fury. "What have you done?" she shouted. "Why did you spoil our garden? It was the only beautiful thing left here, and you've spoiled it." Sean stopped the streamer respectfully, seeing her expression. "It needed tidying," Pippa said weakly. Now, when it was too late, she could see how graceful the grass had been as the accompaniment to Serena's dance that morning, how it had moved with her movement. And she saw, too, how the cutting of the grass might look like a deliberate affront, a contemptuous stroke of brute practicality against imagination and spirit. Serena had a way of construing the most harmlessly neutral acts of provocations. "We couldn't just leave it," Pippa tried to explain. "But why not?" Her question couldn't be answered without invoking the whole fabric of everything. Sean looked tentatively between them. "Should I stop there?" Serena glanced at him, absorbed still in her rage against her sister, scornfully taking in his tan and his naked torso. "Well, you might as well finish it now," she said. "The place is ruined anyway." She stormed off, Jillian and Pippa left behind in the familiar aftershock of one of her scenes, made wry faces at each other. Pippa told Sean to go on and cut the rest. It was all her fault, not his. Upstairs, clenching her fists, Serena stood confronting the full-length mirror in her room. Her ferocity hadn't subsided. She couldn't bear the resumption of the strimmer's noise and thought that she had to go out. She painted on a fresh slash of lipstick, changed her heels for higher ones, fluffed up the thick bird's nest of her rust-black hair, put on dark glasses. The picture panels in the porch door juddered when she slammed it behind her. On her way down through the sloping residential streets to the town center, breaking the sleepy silence with the scrape and rap of her heels, she felt at least the relief of escape. Anything was better than that hospital. Then she sat solitary at an outdoor table, at a cafe on the main street with a black coffee, lighting a cigarette and smoking it. The cigarette's poison, a kind of bravado in the face of sickness and death. Since she'd first had any clear idea of who she was as a teenager, Serena had seen herself set apart like this, dangerous and intriguing, her black clothing outlined against the summer pastels of sloppy holiday makers in their flip-flops or the dowdy decency of her own family. To her credit, she'd never been interested in worldly success or fame, though she had been talented, in a minor way, as a singer and an actress. It had been hard enough, she considered, simply becoming herself. She earned a living now as a freelance legal secretary, cared nothing for the work, and was more than competent, easily making herself indispensable. Today, in any case, over her coffee cup, intense, absent, indifferent to her surroundings, not checking her phone or reading, she had an aura that was just as significant as if she were a celebrity, improbably washed up at the seaside, having shaken off her entourage of admirers or detractors, thirsting to be left alone with her luxuriant inner life. The cafe was quiet. The town's morning bustle had long since subsided. Its wash of tourists receded. Shops were closing already. The trees' elongated shadows stretched at intervals across the road. On the beach, the estuary waters ran up across the flat sand, flooding the stale pools that had been left behind hours earlier in cracks in the jutting shelves of shale. Any remaining families had retreated to a last redoubt, a bank of pebbles marked with a crusty high-tide line of dried seaweed, cracked plastic bottles, washed white bones, driftwood, and faded crisp packets. The water was rich with silt, chocolate brown. A few children investigated at its edge with buckets, paddling where it foamed lazily, curling warm around their ankles, sucking under their soles. After Serena's performance in the garden, Sean might have avoided her when he spotted her. Having finished strimming, he was making his way home to the caravan where he was living temporarily because his wife had kicked him out. On foot, because his vehicle was with his brother-in-law, who was looking at the fuel pump. But he was intrigued and drawn to Serena, who was dressed so exotically and looked so concentrated and self-possessed, with her small, heart-shaped face and painted eyes and mass of hair. He thought he recognized in her bearing and black clothes and cigarette, in the sharp point of experience in her expression, the signs of that Freemasonry of difference, an alternative lifestyle to which he also belonged in his own way, though he'd taken out his earring a while ago, finding it childish. When he was younger, there'd been a passionate frisson between boys like him and certain middle-class girls. Those girls had woken up to sex when the boys of their own sort were still playing Monopoly or practicing wheelies on their BMX bikes. Later, the girls left to go to university or to work elsewhere, and Sean had left too. He'd traveled around in Europe and the Far East and Australia, and then he'd come home and got married and had two kids. Serena didn't look too bad, although he had calculated from things her mother had said that she must be 50 at least. Her cheekbones jutted like knuckles under her white skin, but then he was no oil painting himself these days. He stood beside the cafe table, said that he was sorry she was upset, and waited so that she was forced to acknowledge him. She looked up as if she, too, felt the nudge of the old Freemasonry, only warily. "Don't worry about it. My sisters annoy me." "Well, you're like your mother." She stiffened at his presumption. "I'm not, am I?" "Well, I offered to cut the grass a couple of weeks ago, and she said, 'No, why bother?' I think she liked it the way it was, same as you." Serena stubbed out her cigarette, thoughtfully, gratified. "So then, what did you do when she said not to cut the grass? Just go away? I suppose you needed the money?" Now, you had to be careful with truth when it came to money, Sean knew, although he'd never for one moment have cheated the old lady. He told Serena that he'd done all sorts of odd jobs for her mother around the house, unblocking sinks and changing light bulbs, opening a jammed window, fixing the TV. In fact, though, Evelyn often couldn't think of anything for him to do. If he just sat drinking tea and talking with her, she insisted on paying him anyway. Sliding between his fingers in his pocket the 220s that Pippa had given him, he asked Serena if he could buy her another coffee. When she shook her head, he believed at first that he was dismissed. "Just a glass of water," she added, glancing at passerbys in the street as if they were more interesting than he was. It was a shame about the tooth, she thought, watching him maneuver competently around the tables on his way back from the counter, bearing his own coffee and her glass. Drawing up a chair opposite hers, he sat ripping open little packets of sugar, one after another, to stir into his cup, which perhaps helped to explain why the tooth was missing. Still, he was good-looking, strong, with wiry shoulder-length hair burned yellow by the sun and pushed behind his ears, a skewed long nose that might have been broken once, the hazily intent gaze of a weed smoker. A crowned tooth would be expensive for a casual laborer, though he told her that he was trained as a joiner, with a job coming up soon at the new power station. Serena said that she hated the power station, was opposed to nuclear. Sean shrugged. "We need the work around here." "Well, you could go somewhere else." "I tried that. Anyway, my kids are here. They stay with me at the weekends." She smiled at him warmly, conventionally. "And how old are they?" Once his children are out of in the open, Serena and he could be friendlier. She felt the old tide of flirtation rising between them, promising to lift her from wherever she was stranded. He had a girl, 5, and a boy, 3. I never wanted children, she explained. Probably because I was born with a hole in my heart. My father prayed all night over my crib in the hospital. I can't remember this touching scene, but I've carried it with me, that burden of hope. After his prayers worked, he thought he owned me. It's why I've got this horrible name, too. Well, it's not horrible. Worse than you think. Actually, I'm Angel. Angel Serena. You can imagine why I dropped the angel part. Mom had nothing to do with choosing it. Dad was the sentimental one. Did you know he was headmaster at Daresbrook? He was an awful bully. I'm glad he was never my headmaster. Sean said that he had gone to Daresbrook, but it must have been after her father retired. We heard that it went to the dogs, she said. But then, he would say that, wouldn't he? Sean tried to weigh his experience at school impartially. I didn't react well, he confessed, rueful, to being confined in a classroom. Well, you were probably one of the dogs, I mean, that my father thought it went to. Wondering whether to feel insulted, Sean said that he regretted it now. I wish I had my time over again. She widened her eyes at him, doubting it, and said that she never regretted anything. Whatever happened had to be that way. As she spoke, however, she was waylaid by a vision of her mother in that hospital bed, so miniature and yellow, her jaw slack, absent from herself, held up between the bleeping heart monitor and the drip and the catheter, the tight knot of her long life loosening, the sadness that had evaded Serena when she'd searched for it, so that she had believed her own heart was a dry husk, found her here in the cafe when she least expected it. She blotted her eyes with a tissue, sipped her water. Oh, it's a difficult time for you, Sean said sympathetically. He covered her small, cool hand on the table with his own, which was huge and hot, calloused across the palm, black dirt rimming the nails. Of course, Serena couldn't begin to describe all of her private difficulty, not to a stranger. She pulled her hand away and spoke instead about climate change, the political chaos that would follow it. I should act, she said, but I don't have any conviction. I'm no good at conviction. Sean wrote his number on the back of his receipt from the cafe. Text me, he said, so that I've got your number, too. All right, I will. No, do it now. She smiled, watery-eyed, at his scrap of paper lying untouched on the table between them. Go on, you might as well, in case you need anything, any job's done. She wouldn't text him while he watched, but she picked up his number before she left and dropped it into her bag. That evening, while Pippa and Jillian watched television, Serena went rummaging through the cupboards upstairs, renewed and energized. Her sisters were still jarred by the scene she'd made. She'd always had this trick of unleashing her worst and then being the first to recover from it. "Look what I found," she sang out. But the others were reluctant to move from in front of their documentary on Minoan Crete. Come, see, it's the Bunty Club. Oh, the Bunty Club? Jillian was perplexed. The what? You remember the Bunty Club. We had those secret club meetings in the shed. We swear not to do good and never to help people. Well, I've got no memory of it. Were we horrid? It was just a reaction to Daddy, Pippa reassured her. The actual bad things we did were terribly innocent, mostly. I think we hit his slippers, dug up some potatoes he'd planted in the garden. He always thought it was a fox. We jammed Mom's knitting machine. Bunty was the comic we wanted to read. He said it wasn't suitable. We were only allowed look and learn. It's a treasure trove, Serena said. She stood blocking their view of the television, with a cardboard box in her arms, reading aloud from papers inside it. Chairman Philippa Ann Stiles drew the meeting to a close with 3 cheers for Bunty Club members for all their hard work on doing wrong. Vice Chairman Jillian Elizabeth Stiles seconded the motion. Who knew you were such budding bureaucrats? And actually, wasn't it usually me doing the wrong under orders from you two? Well, you enjoyed it, Pippa said briskly. You wanted to be in the club, and we knew you wouldn't get in as much trouble as us if you were caught, because you were little and they always said you didn't know what you were doing, though I'm sure you knew perfectly well. Serena dropped the box on the carpet. Her sisters knelt heavily beside her to unpack it, exclaiming over the contents. There were the minutes of club meetings and lists of enemies and bad deeds, a top-secret code book, homemade badges covered in Fablon, which fastened with safety pins on the back, a dried-up ink pad, a stamp, a date stamp turned to the 5th of October, 1969. Miss A. Stiles was permitted to enter the meeting on strict condition of sharing all sweets and other grub, etc. All the paperwork was typed, the individual letters not quite aligned and indented deep into the paper, wavering between black ink and red. They had acquired a typewriter when the parish office bought a new one, and it had seemed biblical in and itself, presiding over their playroom, as ancient as Methuselah, too heavy for them to lift, its action thunderous and punitive. When a locked tin cash box rattled intriguingly, Pippa levered it open with a screwdriver, and they were perplexed by what was inside, until she recognized the club's sacred objects. A bone, a screwed-up page from a prayer book. "We spat on it," she said. "A wrapped razor blade, their father's bronze medal for swimming, a gold ring set flashily with a green stone." "A stolen ring," Pippa announced suddenly, quite certainly. "We actually stole it." "No, from who?" "No idea. I knew once, but now I'm simply blank. Not from our parents, obviously. Anyway, it isn't their kind of ring. Imagine Mummy wearing this. The name of the victim ought to haunt us, oughtn't it? So much for a bad conscience. We could have it valued." Pippa dropped the ring back into the cash box. "Best not, perhaps." The textures of the past rose around the sisters like an uneasy dream, alien and stale and intensely familiar. For 20 minutes, it was intoxicating, hilarious. Then, in the present, they began to be bored and their knees were stiff. Jillian still insisted that she didn't remember the club. She was distracted by the television. She and Pippa had visited the palace at Knossos a few years ago with their husbands, who hadn't got on. Pippa had sprained her ankle while clambering on the ruins. It was an awful holiday. Jillian had given her mobile number to the hospital. She left the phone charging on her bedside table and was awoken very early the next morning by its ringing. Whatever her dreams had been, they dispersed in that instant, iridescence breaking up on the surface of deep water. Abruptly, she sat up in bed, pressed the green circle without fumbling. The same nurse who'd been on duty the day before said in an emotional voice that the sisters should come to the hospital at once. "They would leave as soon as they were dressed," Jillian said. Leaping up, sick with excitement and dread, she crossed to the window and parted the curtains, looking out into the garden's subdued blue light as if she had to check that it was still there. The massy forms of the apple trees, the black incontrovertible bulk of the shed, birds stirring, invisible in the undergrowth. This was the exceptional, the awaited day. She was seized and rigid in its tension. She needed to go to her sisters at once and wake them, tell them to get ready. Yet she had the revelation for this one moment to herself. Alone, she rose to its occasion. Through the open window came the long, cool breath of earth. Then, finally, she remembered the Bunty Club. Not all the funny detail, but the actuality of it. The clandestine meetings in the shed, crouching on the plank floor among all those dangerous tools they weren't supposed to go near. The splintery walls fragrant with creosote. Her arms wrapped tight around scabbed knees, feeling scalded and enthralled by what was forbidden. The shed had been ripe with the smells of tomato plants, 3-in-1 oil, mealworms for the bird table, crust of cut grass souring on the blades of the mower. Beams of brilliant light from knot holes pierced the stuffy dimness. Her thighs were wet with sweat under her shorts, and her silky shoulder-length hair tickled her freckled arms, which tasted sun-baked as she sucked at her own skin, leaving purple marks. Clever Pippa had got the idea for their club out of the storybooks, whose contents she seemed to absorb so effortlessly and with actual pleasure. Before Pippa grew into a teenager and she lost her nerve, she had been so full of ideas, running in the garden and in races on sports day, with such flat-footed, eager assurance, her plate flicking bossily behind her, her plain, long face raised to the sun. Jillian had adored and envied her, felt herself formless and dull by contrast. When their father called Jillian his sensible daughter, it had sounded like a consolation prize. The house was still quiet. Her sisters hadn't been awoken by the phone ringing. Important with her mission, Jillian went out onto the landing, calling their names in a low voice, raising her hand to knock before she poked her head around their bedroom doors into the fusty half-life. She had the odd sensation of resuming some ceremonial lift unfinished a long time ago. Then she remembered how fervently she and Pippa had prayed, after Serena was born, for her to live. Their actual baby sister, when eventually she came home from the hospital, had been problematic and prosaic, and not the all-transforming mystery they'd thirsted for. Was this the mystery now? Jillian tried to imagine their mother calling them in from the garden for tea, standing in her apron in the kitchen doorway. But the indefinite figure wouldn't come into focus, dissolving like her dream. In their bedrooms, her sisters were rousing from sleep, lifting their heads to stare at her, confused, embryonic in the cocoons of their duvets, not yet ready for her news. And now, from the book section, The Resistance. Can Science Help Us Change Our Habits? By Jerome Groopman. Several years ago, I bought a smartphone and soon came to love it. Being able to send an email, look up a fact, or buy something no matter where I was meant a previously unimaginable gain in productivity. Every time I got an email, the phone emitted a ping and I would deal with whatever it was, priding myself on my efficiency. Texts arrived with the tones of a French horn and were similarly dispatched. Soon, I was reaching for the device every time it made a sound, like Pavlov's dog salivating when it heard a bell. This started to interfere with work and conversations. The machine had seemed like a miraculous servant, but gradually I became its slave. I'd always prided myself on my willpower. Like most people who've made it through medical training with its early mornings and its long shifts when your friends are partying, I had an established track record of delaying gratification. It didn't matter. When I tried switching the phone to silent, I ended up checking it perhaps even more often, just in case there was something to deal with. The only time I imagined to resist was during Shabbos, when I don't read email. But I'd be watching the clock, counting the hours till I could turn the thing on. For the first time, I could imagine what it's like to be a smoker craving a cigarette. Checking the smartphone had become a bad habit that I couldn't break. Habits, good and bad, have long fascinated philosophers and policymakers. Aristotle surveyed existing notions of virtue and offered this summary. Some thinkers hold that it is by nature that people become good, others that is by habit, and others that it is by instruction. He concluded that habits were responsible. Cicero called habit second nature, a phrase that we still use. And when Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Paper No. 27, considered how to create citizens who would obey the federal laws of the newly formed republic, he used another proverbial phrase, man is very much a creature of habit. If federal law permeated matters at the state level, it would seem part of everyday life. The more it circulates through those channels and currents in which the passions of mankind naturally flow, the less will it require the aid of the violent and perilous expedients of compulsion, he wrote. In the modern era, habits have become a significant area of scientific inquiry. Psychologists have explored the genesis of habitual behavior and its impact on health and happiness. William James, echoing Aristotle, wrote, "All our life, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, practical, emotional, and intellectual, bearing us irresistibly toward our destiny." Few of us would like to think of ourselves in such passive terms. What about willpower? Marketers flatter our sense of agency with slogans like, "Just do it," Nike, "Declare your path," New Balance. Much popular psychology, too, bolsters our belief in self-control. In the famous Stanford Marshmallow Experiment, devised by Walter Mischel in the 1960s, children were seated alone in front of a marshmallow and were scored on whether they resisted gobbling it down. The resulting determination of a child's level of executive function supposedly distinguishes life's winners and losers, predicting such things as performance on the SAT, duration of relationships, and career success. But how can that be if we're just creatures of habit? In Good Habits, Bad Habits, published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, the social psychologist Wendy Wood refutes both James' determination and glib exhortations to be proactive and seeks to give the general reader more realistic ideas for how to break habits. Drawing on her work in the field, she sees the task of sustaining positive behaviors and quelling negative ones as involving an interplay of decisions and unconscious factors. Our minds, Wood explains, have multiple separate but interconnected mechanisms that guide behavior. But we are aware only of our decision-making ability, a phenomenon known as the introspection illusion. And that may be why we overestimate its power. The executive functions that make willpower possible give us, she writes, the sense of agency that we recognize as me. But that comes at a cost in terms of effort. To go about our lives, we need to make some behaviors automatic. Functional MRI scans have given researchers a peek into the respective neural networks that are active during rote and conscious tasks. A brain scan of someone learning a task shows activity in the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, networks associated with decision-making and executive control. With repetition of a task, brain activity moves into areas of the putamen and the basal ganglia, deep in what Wood calls the rudimentary machinery of our minds. There, a task is turned into a habit. These more primitive areas of the brain demand less of our mental energy. Whole sequences of actions become linked, a process known as chunking. When we get into a car and drive off, we don't need to think about the separate actions of buckling a seatbelt, turning on the ignition, putting the car in drive, checking the mirrors and the blind spot, and pressing the gas pedal. All these steps, chunked into a single unit in the memory, are triggered by the environmental cue of getting into your car. This frees us up to concentrate on what most requires conscious attention. We can think about where we're going or the day's tasks and keep an eye out for anything unusual on the road. Wood's research originally focused not on habits, but on persistence. For one-off occasional behaviors, like getting a flu shot, conscious decisions were all that was required. For behaviors involving repetition, though, habits were crucial. William James estimated that 99 hundredths or possibly 999 thousandths of our activity is purely automatic and habitual. This was a guess. Wood, however, devised a study to quantify just how often people act out of habit. Using a research technique known as experience sampling, she had participants spend 2 days recording what they did while they were doing it. Results varied across the group studied, but the basic finding was that our actions are habitual 43% of the time. This explains why conscious knowledge is not in itself enough to change behavior, and why public health initiatives that educate people about healthy choices tend to fail. In 1991, the National Cancer Institution determined that only 8% of Americans were aware of the recommendations to eat at least 5 servings of fruit and vegetables daily. A national campaign was declared, 5 a day for better health. 6 years later, 39% of Americans knew about 5 servings a day, a nearly 5-fold increase. But actual diets had barely changed. In 2007, government officials tried again, launching a program called Fruits and Veggies, More Matters. Even so, by 2018, only 12% of Americans ate the recommended 2 servings of fruit daily, and only 9% ate 3 servings of vegetables. Simply informing us of what's good for us doesn't work, because so much of our eating, cooking, and shopping is governed by habit. In Michelle's marshmallow experiment, only a quarter of the subjects were able to resist eating the marshmallow for 15 minutes. This implies that a large majority of us lack the self-control required to succeed in life. But a less discussed part of this study suggests a way of circumventing our frailty. The researchers compare the results of 2 situations. In one, children could see the marshmallow in front of them. In the other, they knew that it was there, but they couldn't see it. On average, the children lasted only 6 minutes when presented with visible temptation, but could manage 10 minutes if the treat was hidden. For Wood, this outcome shows that self-control is not so much an inherent disposition, but instead a reflection of the situation we are in. A few tweaks to our environment may enable us to emulate people who seem more disciplined. A study of self-control among college students bears out this hypothesis. The students were told to report every time they thought, oops, I shouldn't do this. For instance, when they stayed up too late, overslept, overate, or procrastinated. They were most successful at adopting productive behaviors not when they resolved to do better or distracted themselves from temptation, but when they altered their environment. Instead of studying on a couch in a dorm with a TV close by, they went to the library. They ate better when they removed junk food from the dorm refrigerator. Successful self-control, Wood writes, came from essentially covering up the marshmallow. Even people who score high on self-control questionnaires may owe their apparent virtue to situational factors rather than to sheer fortitude. A study of such people in Germany found that they reported resisting temptation surprisingly rarely. They were living their lives in a way that hid the marshmallow almost all the time, Wood writes. This observation leads to the crux of her book's thesis. The path to breaking bad habits lies not in resolve, but in restructuring our environment in ways that sustain good behaviors. Wood cites a psychologist, Kurt Lewin, who argued that behavior was influenced by a constellation of forces, analogous to gravity or to the fluid dynamics that make a river run faster or slower. Those forces work depending on where you are, who's around you, the time of day, and your recent actions. We achieve situational control, paradoxically, not through willpower, but by finding ways to take willpower out of the equation. The central force for eliminating bad habits, according to Wood, is friction. If we can make bad habits more inconvenient, then inertia can carry us in the direction of virtue, without ever requiring us to be strong. She cites the ways in which increased friction has produced a decline in smoking, laws that ban it in restaurants, bars, airplanes, and trains, taxes that have helped triple the price of cigarettes in the U.S. in the past 20 years, the purge of cigarettes from vending machines, and of tobacco ads from TV and the radio. Wood ends her book with advice for those of us who have become hostages to our smartphones. She offers a stepwise strategy. First, recognize your dependency and acknowledge how the habit disrupts work, social interactions, and safe driving. Next, control the context cues, meaning identify what triggers you to grab the phone. For me, the cues are oral, the ping, the French horn, and visual pop-ups on the screen. I already knew that putting the phone on silent wasn't enough to break the habit. But, as in the marshmallow experiment, out of sight could be out of mind. In the mornings, preparing breakfast, I found that it helped to leave the phone in another room. In the car, it went in the glove compartment. When walking around, I'd put it in a zippered pocket. There were other ways of generating friction and making the habit harder to indulge. Turning the phone off completely was much more effective than silencing it. Not because I wasn't curious about who might have emailed me, but because turning it back on was a hassle. Wood advises us to come up with new rewards as substitutes for the ones the phone provided. I listened to music on the car radio. In the evening, instead of scrolling through tweets and emails, I sought out authors I'd never read. At the end of each day, I felt calmer and free. Well, we have time for a few cartoons. The first cartoon, we see two caterpillars in a tree. Hanging in the branch above them is a cocoon. One caterpillar says to the other one, "I don't feel ready to commit to a cocoon either. But do you ever worry we'll wake up one day and be 40 and still caterpillars?" In the next cartoon, we see a man kneeling on one knee, with a ring in one hand, holding a woman's hand who's sitting on a couch. He says, "Sally, will you make me the happiest man in the world? And accept full responsibility if I should fail to be the happiest man in the world?" And in the last cartoon, we see the pitcher, catcher, and a manager having a conference on the mound. The manager says, "It's such a nice day. Just let him walk the bases." Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.